it is Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Bo, also known as History Bro, and I'm Josh. So we are going to be talking about today the question, did humans domesticate ourselves? And you might be thinking, well, that's kind of a strange question. And I think it probably helps to actually define what the self-domestication hypothesis is and why people might believe it. So it proposes that humans have undergone a process of self-domestication in a similar way to animals being domesticated by humans. Obviously, we know what domesticated animals are. So cows, sheep, dogs, cats, that sort of thing. I'm sure you've all encountered one at some point. So you have some degree of frame of reference for what domestication entails and how they're different from wild animals. Although we are going to look into the differences between the two, because I think you need to understand domestication at a far deeper level than most people colloquially do to understand whether humans have been self-domesticated in the first place and whether there is a fair resemblance between the two. But the process, according to the people who assert it, changes both human behaviour and their physical characteristics. And it changes both because through things like making human beings more cooperative, less aggressive, and more tolerant of each other, which is what the proponents of self-domestication propose, that changes our genes, and our genes have multiple different effects beyond just one thing. You don't have a gene that solely acts on, say, your eyesight or I don't know, how thick your beard hair growth is. They enact on multiple different things. And you could have a gene that is related to physical appearance and might change in that way. But it also affects behavior as well. So for an example, the FTO gene has been associated with obesity and body mass index, but has also been linked to things like cognitive function, which is like your psychological abilities, depression and addiction as well. So there's lots of different things that a single gene can do beyond what you might think. So the argument pretty much is that through selecting for being more cooperative, less aggressive, and more tolerant, it's changed us physiologically. Like, it's changed the structure of our face and potentially many other things as well. So it sounds rather counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Mm.
What's your sort of gut feeling towards it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing how it's some sort of millennia long, or maybe millions of years long, feedback mm-hmm. loop.
Well, when it actually began is kind of a bit of a debate, because there are some people that suggest that, well, maybe it's fair to say that this was sort of 300,000 years ago when we first started becoming anatomically modern humans. You may remember when we did the Origins of Humanity contemplations a few episodes back, the Jebel Ehud skull in North Africa, which I think was about 295,000 years ago, but yet it seemed anatomically modern. And of course, there is some sort of overlap period where populations of humans would be more modern than others around that sort of time. But they're suggesting that the modernity is the self-domestication aspect. But then there are other people, and I think this is the more mainstream view, that believe that it's been a fairly recent change in that it's occurred within anatomically modern human beings. So there are two different kind of groups within this sort of section of the self-domestication hypothesis advocates. And there's the people who believe it was between 40,000 years ago and 25,000 years ago. And then there are those who believe it is from about 12,000 years ago, or roughly when we started to form societies, larger societies, and had agriculture. So there are lots of cutoffs, which seems to me to indicate that, well, if you can't even identify the period that it happened, doesn't that weaken the strength of your argument?
Mm.
But we're going to look at the evidence, and I think that actually this conflict between the different dates perhaps gives an impression of it being weaker than it really is. because some people even indicate that it's 3,000 years ago, and I think that that's too few generations to have any meaningful changes, really.
Also, isn't the picture, the real sort of reality, sort of slightly more higher definition picture, just so much more complicated than that anyway? What I mean is that there'll be people alive today which, left to themselves, wouldn't be domesticated for, and what, you know, it's difficult to just define exactly what we mean by that anyway, but you know what I mean. So, for example, you've got people that have got much more ancient genes than others floating around in the system, haven't they?
I'm like, pretty sure I've got some Neanderthal.
Like, everyone's got some Neanderthal.
Well, if they're European or Asian,
I thought it was everyone. It just depended. Oh, yeah, it's even more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yeah, because some parts of Africa don't.
Let's just say Europeans, for example. Mm-hmm. But between different individuals, you can have there's quite a big window of how much or little Neanderthal genes you might have.
I know that Ozzy Osbourne supposedly has a disproportionately large amount of Neanderthal DNA in him.
Isn't it counterintuitive as well, that it doesn't necessarily make you stupider or doesn't necessarily mean you have a heavier brow line or anything like that, does it? It's not as simple as that. You don't look more like a Neanderthal or anything.
I think it's such a small percentage, and there's probably a large degree of overlap because we have common ancestry, that it doesn't really affect you that much. And you might have these markers of lineage to Neanderthals, say, but it's not necessarily that you're living in a cave, dragging your knuckles on the ground. Not that they did that in the first place, by the way.
Yeah.
They seem to have had culture, and they made art and sophisticated tools. So they're comparable, certainly.
If you talk about human domestication, if you took some peoples from the world and set them up on, some sort of desert island type situation, they would create a small proto-civilization, and others wouldn't. Mm-hmm. They would descend into a Lord of the Flies type crazy violent anarchy or something.
That's the latter being my utopia, of course.
I don't know, I feel like it's a process, an ongoing process. And even if we zoom out a little bit, even more than just the question of self-domestication, human evolution, or all evolution, is sort of a never-ending process.
Right? Of course,
So whether you say it was 3,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago, or 300,000 years ago.
It would have been going on regardless,
Right. And also, if we extrapolate into the future, assuming we don't annihilate ourselves, in 50,000 years, we won't look like we do today. Or in a million years, let's say.
We probably won't
look anything like what we do today. We will have kept evolving. It doesn't just end. We're not like the end products now.
it's a tendency of human beings today, because we occupy such a safe spot at the top of the food chain, to think that, well, we're done. Mm. That's it. Pack up and leave. But there are lots of adaptations to the world around us that still make a difference. Like, there are lots of, supposedly one of the ways which we're evolving now is we're selecting for intelligence more and more. Right. So potentially we're going to get more intelligent, although things are looking more and more like the film Idiocracy. Mm. At the same time, so I don't know how that quite works.
Well, there's the idea that we become more and more cerebral, maybe use our ears less and less. You know the idea of an alien, a grey, that is like a more evolved, it's got a big head, big old head with a giant brain, doesn't really need ears, doesn't need good hearing for hunting anymore, all that sort of thing.
But I would be very surprised if we lost the use of our ears, because ears are useful for lots of things.
Lose it entirely.
Okay, reduced.
You only need a small hole in the side of your head. You don't need big ear lobes or anything. I don't know.
I think, generally speaking, you don't lose an ability if you don't need it. It kind of hangs around as a relic. That's why, like, a tailbone is not necessarily too much of an impairment to a human being. It's a relic that we don't need anymore, but we've still got it because it doesn't really impede us in any way. Right. So unless, you know, there was a selection of aliens fitting their ears in space helmets, where if you had two big ears, you couldn't fly into space, then there might be something like that. it is worth highlighting as well that this self-domestication hypothesis is not... even evolutionary biologists saying, you know what, this is the sole factor. They're just saying that it might have been an influence. Because, of course, they're not ones to deny all of the different factors involved in it, because quite often they're the ones that study it and understand the complexity to a better degree than most people, to be fair.
Yeah.
So when they talk about self-domestication, they're not saying, OK, this is why human beings are as they are now. That's not necessarily what's being said. It's simply that, is this a key factor in explaining why human beings are as they are today, or is this just a cursory thing that allowed us to live in civilization as we do? Because, of course, there is the question of, we're primates, there's no denying that, and we're living in a society where 99% of the time, 99% of the people are perfectly peaceful. And I'm not sure how up to scratch the audience are with their primatology, but that doesn't happen very often in pretty much any of our relatives. Maybe bonobos sometimes, but even so, they're not necessarily to the same degree as us, obviously.
Yeah.
But we will be talking about them in a second. So moving on to what we actually know about domestication, there are some general rules of domestication about what happens to the domesticated animal compared to its wild variant. So the first thing is that it reduces in size, which is somewhat counterintuitive, because you'd think, well, it's got a wealth of food. Well, being in captivity, why would it get smaller? Mm. That doesn't make any sense, because the wild animal has to actually work for its food. It doesn't get it delivered to it in the same way. But of course, if you're selecting for size in the case of, say, a cow, where you want as much meat on there as possible, obviously that doesn't happen. So this is a general rule. But if something is being bred into them, like cows are not bred to be smaller, that's for sure. They're bred to be bigger. Yeah. And therefore, that doesn't necessarily apply to them. But generally speaking, when you domesticate something, make it less aggressive towards humans, that's generally speaking what we mean by domestication, as in you're able to keep this animal without it trying to attack you. So purely in that sense, these things would probably shrink. But there are, of course, other things, because they didn't just domesticate them to have them around as pets. They wanted them to do stuff. That's why, say, border collies are very intelligent, because they have to round up sheep and things like that. They've got a specific role. It's why terriers like to chase really small mouse or rat-sized objects, because that's what they've been bred to do. It's deeply lodged in their brains.
Mm.
So another thing is a short face and small teeth. This is something that is seemingly true of lots of domesticated animals. It shrinks the size of the face and makes the teeth smaller. I suppose smaller teeth is just an adaptation to better feed, maybe, I don't know. There are lots of different reasons for this. But it also, something that I thought was interesting, makes something look cuter to human beings, which might be part of the reason that it's been bred in that way. Because if you're selectively breeding something to be receptive to you, I'm thinking of particularly dogs, well, you want them to look nice. You want them to not only be friendly towards you, but you want to be friendly to them. And if they look really ugly and horrible, and there are some dog breeds that certainly fit the bill there, you might not want to pet them as much. So another factor is reduced sexual dimorphism, which just means the difference between the size in men and women. So I've used the example in the past of baboons, where the baboon males are massive and the females are quite small. And then you can look at other primates, like bonobos, for example, where they've not got nearly as much of a difference between the two. And there are lots of implications for that, in that if there's reduced sexual dimorphism, it normally means that there's more free love, to borrow the terms of the hippie generation, in that they're more likely not to be monogamous, and they're more likely to engage in things like homosexual sex and things like that, which does occur in the natural world. Again, using the example of the bonobo, which I'm going to mention quite a lot.
It's interesting, because there's a relatively high amount of sexual dimorphism in humans, isn't there?
There is, but relative to other primates, it's probably less than is usual.
but relative to the entire animal kingdom, because most animals really are sort of almost identical, lots and lots of animals, they're sort of almost identical. You know, like I'm thinking across the entire animal kingdom I'm talking about.
And I'm not entirely sure whether it's, I know it's certainly true of primates. I'm not sure whether the applicability of this understanding becomes weaker when it's applied to other mammals. But I think it still seems to hold, as far as I'm aware, because of course, when you have a large amount of sexual dimorphism, it normally means that the male has specialised into some sort of niche to win over. I'm thinking of, say, is it a lyrebird or something like that? I might be thinking, no, it's the birds of paradise, that's it.
Okay, right.
Yeah, where the males are very, very colourful and it's all about competing with one another, whereas the females look relatively ordinary. They look kind of like a female blackbird. They're kind of brown and small and unassuming. And it's because there's a difference there, because there's a niche and they normally mate for life, as far as I understand.
Well, like a peacock and a peahen. It's the male, the peacock, that's got those incredible tail feathers. A peahen is nowhere near as spectacular.
Yeah.
There are some examples where the female is bigger. I'm thinking the immediate thing I think of is a black widow, famously. The female is massive and the male is tiny.
But I think that's true of lots of insects, though, isn't
it? Even in mammals, though, like I know the blue whale, I believe the female is bigger than the male in blue whales.
It's certainly no... there's no written rule where the males are always largest.
Right. So just as a very quick aside note, interested in what would be the biggest blue whale? It would be a pregnant female with gigantism. Anyway.
I'm glad we've got that settled.
Yeah. There's something else I wanted to say, though, about, we'll just go back ever so briefly, but still the same point we're making here, but on the gene side, because of course I'm no expert in the human genome or sort of gene science or anything, but it does seem that you need a relatively small amount or really a tiny difference or mutation in genes for it potentially to play out to be quite a massive difference in the real world in real time. There's one example where butterflies can change their colour in like one generation due to external due to the external world. You know, you must know the example where the trees became very sooty during the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, that's a moth, isn't it? I forgot the name of the moth.
But you know, anyway, the point of all that is to say that, I know it's only moths, and it's a quite simple example, but it can happen quite quickly. It doesn't necessarily take millions of years.
It does depend on what the trait is and what the animal is as well, because for an animal that relies on camouflage in a changing environment, there might be a bit of an incentive to have very changeable genes in certain areas and fixed ones in others. And I think that that's probably what's going on with those butterflies and those moths, is that they can change that aspect of themselves quite easily. And it's not like if a human being moved to a different habitat, they would necessarily change. It would take many, many generations. Right. Of natural selection.
If you allowed the natural selection to play out naturally, rather than... a lot of the things you were talking about there, having a smaller face and smaller teeth when things become domesticated, I was just thinking of dogs largely.
Yeah. I think that's a good example for it as well, because it's very clear most dogs don't have teeth like wolves.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I saw an anecdote being told. I think it was on Joe Rogan, actually. And I can't remember if it was Joe Rogan himself or his guest, talking about lap dogs. How what they would do is a dog would have a litter of puppies. And when the puppies were really still quite small, they would do a simple test for aggression, just sort of poke them or roughhouse them about a bit. And any dog that showed any aggression, they just kill it, get rid of it. And the ones that were docile and didn't do anything, didn't react, they're allowed to live. And within very, very few generations of that, half a dozen generations or less, you've got only docile lap dogs. It's very, very, very quick. And of course, if you leave natural selection still on its own,
it would trend probably back towards the aggression.
You never know. There's another great story from, I think it's The Ascent of Man, where they talk about in Japan, in a particular bay in Japan, there's lots of crabs and there's like a pattern.
I know this,
I was just telling everyone out there. There's a pattern on the shell of the crab that looks like the face of a samurai, quite specifically the face of a samurai. Mm-hmm. And it was just purely where the people over a few hundred years, the people, whenever they saw a crab that seemed to have that pattern on its back, they would throw it back and allow it to live. For no other reason than a sentimental reason. There's no other reason than that. And anyway, hundreds of years later, but only a few hundred years, they're the only crabs. You know, the normal crab with a plain shell of that species didn't survive at all. And you're left with, and it became more and more specifically samurai-looking face. Not just a bit, not just sort of vaguely resembled it, but it looks really like a samurai face. Of a samurai warrior.
I find that story really quite compelling, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a very clear demonstration of what's going on here.
Yeah.
And how humans can have a hand in it, even unintentionally.
Right, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I've got a little bit away from your point. Sorry.
But there are two other main traits that change with domestication. There are changes in fur colour and texture. Normally the fur gets fluffier, and quite often the colour changes. So in dogs and other animals in particular, you get mixtures of different colours or spottiness or things like that, which tends not to occur in nature. When you see a wild dog in nature, for example, in, say, Africa, the colours are adapted for its environment rather than, say, a dog that is bred in, say, Britain, sticking out like a sore thumb because it's black and white or something like that. Whereas that's not going to make it very camouflaged in the environment.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, isn't it? Like how even people find that some dogs, or not even dogs, could be horses or cattle as well, that they think it's cute that they look like they're wearing socks, right? So you have a dog that, or it can be a horse as well, that you want it to be completely tan but with white socks. And so you breed for that, and quite quickly you get exactly what you want. And yeah, the idea of a Dalmatian, for example, that just doesn't... You get all sorts of animals with stripes, don't you? Tiger stripes, etc. But the idea of spots, like a Dalmatian, again, that's very specifically... It's been very specifically bred for that, hasn't it?
Yeah. It doesn't occur in wolves naturally, we know that much.
Yeah.
So the final thing is smaller brains, and we're going to be looking at that in the human context later on as well. But all of these seem to be... unintentional consequences of selecting for less aggression. It changes all of these different things. And you may notice that compared to our ancestors and other apes, we are smaller in size. We do have smaller teeth and a shorter face in the sense of, you know, it's flatter rather than stretched out, sort of elongated like a chimpanzee. We do have reduced sexual dimorphism relative to other primates. I mean, we don't really have a fur colour. we've lost our hair, although that seems to be something that happened millions of years ago. So I don't think that's necessarily part of the self-domestication thing. I don't think that's part of the debate. We know that that happened long before human beings existed in their modern form. And smaller brains. You might be saying, hang on a minute, smaller brains. But no. Relatively recently, our brains have shrank. So I'm going to be looking at that later on. But
I must say, just for, super quick to say that, I found it very interesting when we did that contemplations on early humans, or it was a couple, wasn't it? That something, if you just take the pure weight of their brain, it would be bigger or heavier than ours.
Yes, that's
it's
right.
It's obviously less sophisticated in what it's capable of. But in terms of pure volume or weight, it was bigger or heavier. It's interesting, isn't it? But it goes back to that old thing. Well, it's not all about size. I mean, what otherwise...
Size isn't everything, that's right.
Otherwise, a blue whale would be the cleverest thing, right? Mm-hmm. If its brain is the size of a van.
Car, isn't it?
Right, yeah. And why isn't it extremely intelligent? Well, it's
not all about that. It's about... Yeah. It's about the number of neural networks, more specifically. The number of folds physiologically. So as an example of the impact of domestication on animals compared to their wild counterparts, dogs have on average 29% smaller brains than wolves. Pigs have 34% smaller brains than wild pigs. Cow brains are 25% smaller than aurochs, which I believe is the origin of the cow. And interestingly enough, bulls bred for bullfighting, which are bred for aggression, have the largest brains of any domesticated cattle. So I think that's relatively resounding, because those are quite significant differences as well, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, that's
in
big, yeah.
A multitude of different animals. So I think it's safe to say that this is a pretty well-established phenomenon. We know this is going on. This is part of domestication. And I wanted to look at the most recent case of domestication, and that is the Russian domesticated red fox. Have you heard about this before?
Yeah, briefly. I don't know about it in any real detail, but I'll let you talk about it. But all I would say is that a normal undomesticated fox, even if it was extremely friendly and you coaxed it into your home and befriended it, they can't be taught to not go to the toilet everywhere. You can't
teach them that.
That's why lots of people would love to have a fox as a pet, but you can't really let it in the house. Because it won't use a tray, or it won't be taught to go outside or anything. Whereas I'll let you talk about the Russian. Yeah.
Domesticated
finally,
doesn't necessarily mean they would be fit to be a pet. I mean, you wouldn't keep a cow in your house. You wouldn't keep a sheep in your house, even though they are domesticated. It doesn't necessarily mean tame and friendly in the sense of a dog. But yes, here's the picture on screen of what a red fox looks like. I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise to most people in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm. They are really cute.
I do like foxes.
Have you seen foxes up close in real life?
Loads of times.
Yeah, right. They're really cute, aren't they? You wish you could just grab it and stroke it like a dog and play around with it, but you just can't.
But yes, what happened was Dmitry Belyaev, who was a Soviet geneticist, which sounds very sinister, but he actually was doing probably one of the more wholesome pieces of Soviet research going, started a program in 1959, and he sought to understand the process of domestication and its effects genealogically on an animal that hadn't previously been domesticated, and that is, of course, the fox. And I think he concluded that the fox is kind of similar to a dog, and therefore you can kind of make some analogies, but not that many, because of course it's its own distinct animal with its own differences. As you suggested, it can't be house trained in the same way that a dog can. So yes, it was to look at particularly how wolves became modern domesticated dogs. That was the main thing. And Belyaev, I think his name is, I'm probably going to butcher this repeatedly, believed that a key factor for this domestication was the behaviour, which is unsurprising, because you select animals based on how tame they are towards you, how aggressive they are towards you, and therefore he selected which foxes in captivity could breed based on how tame they were and how friendly they were towards humans. And that pretty much meant walking next to their cage, sticking your finger in there, seeing if they tried to bite you. And it's a relatively simple, foolproof method of seeing how aggressive they are. Do they try and bite you? If the answer is yes, they're probably not tame. But the most tame ones got to breed. And then he believed that through selecting for certain kinds of behaviour, you would eventually get a domesticated fox. And I'm going to read from the research paper that the person who succeeded from him wrote in the early 2000s about their actual results and what happened from this experiment. And it's titled Early Canid Domestication, the Farm Fox Experiment. I'm going to read a little bit here, so do apologise if you don't like hearing people read. But physically, the foxes differ markedly on their from their wild relatives. Some of the differences have obvious links to changes in their social behaviour. In dogs, for example, it is well known that the first weeks of life are crucial for forming primary social bonds with human beings. The window of bonding opens when a puppy becomes able to sense and explore its surroundings, and it closes when the pup starts to fear unknown stimuli. According to our studies, non-domesticated fox pups start responding to auditory stimuli on day 16 after birth, and their eyes are completely open by day 18 or 19. On average, our domesticated fox pups responded to sounds 2 days earlier and opened their eyes a day earlier than their non-domesticated cousins. Non-domesticated foxes first show the fear response at 6 weeks of age, and domestic ones show it after 9 weeks or even later. Dogs show it at 8 to 12 weeks, depending on the breed. And as a result, domesticated pups have more time to become incorporated into a human social environment. I mean, that's obviously quite well explained. I mean, it's coming from the researcher that's running the experiment. So it's quite clear here that it's changed fundamental things, such as how long something is an infant, or how long it takes to properly start developing from being a newborn. Mm. There's a longer period of time. There's a delayed infancy. And I mean, to analogize to human beings again, out of lots of animals in the animal kingdom, human infants are the most incompetent from birth.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.